So what I'm going to talk about today is employee compensation and what you need to know and kind of the questions you need to ask. I think one of the interesting things is people spend, you know, a lot of time doing research on their consumer electronics purchases, looking for a computer, picking out a phone. You know, people spend time investing in the research. And I think one of the interesting things is people don't spend a lot of time trying to understand their equity compensation when they get an offer from a company. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, when people are researching electronics, they know what questions to ask. They know where to get the information. And when it comes to, you know, an offer letter, people don't generally know what are the right questions to ask and how do they get the information to really make a good evaluation. And in both situations, you know, it's something you're going to live with for a number of years, right? If you get a computer or a phone or whatever, right, like this is something you're going to spend a lot of time on. And if you go join a startup, it's something that you're likely very passionate about and something you're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy out of the way over a few years. And so, you know, it'd be good to know up front what that equity is worth and what it could be worth. So anytime you get an offer, right, there's kind of two very standard components, right? You'll get some salary, some bonus, cash compensation. It's relatively self-explanatory, consistent across almost every company in the world. And then you'll get some equity. And the equity really comes in two different types that you'll see in an offer letter. One is stock options, and one is restricted stock units. And there are two different kinds of stock options. There's incentive stock options, which people will call ISOs, and they're non-qualified stock options, which people will call NSOs. And I'll get into the distinction between those two a little bit later. But these are the two types of equity that you'll generally see on offer letters. I think what you have to realize is that in neither case is either one of them stock, right? These are different forms of equity that can convert into stock. So let's talk a little bit about how an option works. What an option is it's a contract between you and the company, and it gives you the right to buy a share of the company in the future at a fixed price, right? So that's all it is. It gives you the right to convert into stock in the future. So let's just do like a really, you know, straightforward example. If as part of an offer, someone gives you 150,000 stock options, and let's say the strike price on those options is 20 cents, in order for you to convert those options into stock, you can exercise them, which basically means that you're going to have to pay the company 20 cents for every option. So if you can do a little math, multiply 150,000 by 20 cents, you come up with 30 grand. And if you take 30 grand out of your pocket and you pay the company, they will in turn give you 150,000 shares. Right? So that's the mechanic, and that's what people mean when they say, I'm going to exercise my stock options. And they're a little bit more complicated than restricted stock units. These are actually super simple. There's no strike price. You don't have to exercise anything. They just sit there. And the difference is that, as opposed to paying for them, you get a share of the company when there's some kind of liquidity event. And when people say liquidity event, they generally mean an IPO or an acquisition, something where the stock gets converted into cash or something that's pretty liquid, i.e. stock on NASDAQ, right? And when that happens, the company will just automatically give you a share. So, you know, in the example of Facebook, right, there are a bunch of RSU holders. When the company goes public, actually 6 months after the company goes public, they're going to hand those people shares in the company. And the difference between this and options is you just don't have a lot of control, right? The company will just give you a share one day, and when it happens, that's generally a good thing because it means you're making money. Now, no matter what kind of equity you have, you'll almost certainly have some kind of vesting schedule. And what that basically means is when you show up on day one, you don't start with all of your stock. You get it over time, right? This is meant to be a way of compensating people that incentivizes them to stay with the company for a long period of time. And the most common vesting schedule that you'll see is usually like a 4-year vest with a 1-year cliff. And what that means is you'll get your equity over time, so in this case, 4 years. And what the 1-year cliff means is if you leave in, let's say, 2 months or 6 months or 9 months, you don't get anything, right? You have to be there for at least a year. So up until day 364, you actually get no equity. On day 365, you get a quarter of your equity. So if you divide 150,000 by 4, you get 37,500. I tried to pick numbers that, you know, you'll see turn out to be pretty common, right? These are numbers that might make sense for a lot of companies you might get an offer from. And so, you know, if you're there for a year and 1 month, you would get 40,625. And so basically what happens is after you get past the 1-year cliff, you just vest monthly. So it's just a linear a linear process. You know, if you're there for 2 years, you get half your equity. That'd be $75,000. 3 years, 4 years, you get all of it, right? So after 4 years, you own all of your options, and that's kind of the end of it, right? So let's just do kind of talk about an example offer, something that, you know, perhaps a bunch of people have considered or are considering or hope to consider sometime soon. You're looking at, you know, joining some company. Let's say it's an early stage company, and you know that you would be employee 10. And you were reading on TechCrunch, and there was some article about how they raised a $5 million Series A. So you've got a little information about the company, and you're excited about it, obviously, because you've been interviewing there. And so, you know, they've finally gotten to the point where they want to give you an offer. And this is just an example of a relatively standard offer, right? They'll give you $75,000 salary, use the same numbers as before, 150,000 options, 20-cent strike price, 4-year vest with a 1-year cliff. So if you look at the offer, you know, it's actually a pretty standard offer. Salary is probably lower than what you could get if you went to go work at a company like Microsoft or Google. And the whole concept here is that you should value the equity, and that should compensate you for taking that salary versus, you know, going to work for a big company. But the question is, well, what are those options really worth, and how do you go about figuring that out? And what you want to understand is, what is that worth today, and what could it be worth in the future? Because you're obviously going to this company because you think things are going to go well. It's going to be a, you know, it's going to be a big company, and you know, you're going to help create that. So what could this stock be worth in the future? So the question is, how do you go about figuring that out? And the way you want to do this math is starting by understanding what percentage of the company you own. And you also want to understand what the value of that is at today's valuation. So there are a couple questions you need to ask the company. And I think a lot of people don't know to ask these questions, and that they don't also realize that they have a right to ask these questions. Because if you don't ask some basic questions, there's absolutely no way that you can figure out what this is worth. And the whole point is, you should think your equity is worth something, otherwise why are you joining a startup? So the first question you want to ask is, what are the total number of outstanding shares? Because you're getting the option to buy 150,000 shares. How many shares are there? Is there 150,000? Are there 10 million, 100 million, a billion, right? Companies can have any number of shares they want. So you just need to ask how many outstanding shares there are. And you also want to know what the current valuation is, because it gives you a sense of what your, you can do some math to figure out what your equity is worth today. Sometimes, you know, people don't necessarily like writing these numbers down, but as someone who's joining a company, these are very reasonable questions to ask. And, you know, whether or not they tell you over the phone or send you an email, it doesn't really matter, but you definitely have a right to ask them. So let's just use the numbers that we have. Let's say you talk to the company and it turns out that they have 30 million outstanding shares. So if you have 150,000 options, you do some quick division, and it turns out that you would own 0.005 of the company. So on a percentage basis, that's half a point, right? So it's half a percent. And when people talk about equity, they generally talk about it in the context of, you know, it's a point, right? So 1 point would be 1%, 5 points would be 5%, half a point would be 0.5%. But they also talk about it in the context of basis points. So it's a little bit confusing because it also uses the word points, but the gist of it is that there are 100 basis points in 1%. And so you can convert back and forth between these things. And in this case, where you own half a percent, half a point, that's also equal to 50 basis points. And if you had 0.01% of the company, that'd be 1 basis point. So it's just another way of talking about the same thing, but it's important to understand when people give you answers and they say, you know, you have 1 point, it's usually worth asking, do you mean like 1 basis point or 1 point? Because there's a big difference between 1% of the company and 0.01% of the company. So now that you have a sense of, now that you've done the math, you understand what percentage of the company you own, you can get a sense of what your equity is worth today. So you talk to the CEO or your recruiter or HR, whoever, and they tell you that Series A round that they just did was at a $20 million valuation. So since you know you own 0.005 of the company, you can multiply those two numbers together, and that means that you have, your equity is currently worth 100 grand. Now keep in mind, though, that you're actually vesting into that over a period of 4 years. So what that means is you're effectively getting an extra $25,000 a year. So you add that to the $75,000 base salary, and you know that's starting to look closer to like a big company salary. The benefit to equity, though, is that it could be worth a lot more. The negative is, you know, could be worth nothing, right? That's the risk of joining a startup, but obviously you want to pick companies that you think it's that are going to be successful. And when you're thinking about this, you want to think about what are the various outcomes, right? So if the company were to go public or were to get acquired, what's kind of the probability distribution of various things? And, you know, you can pick round numbers. I don't think, it's not an exact science. You go talk to investors and there's not an exact science there. No one knows the company's going to be worth exactly $100 million or $500 million. But you can kind of guess at how big the market is and how quickly the company's growing and get a sense of, you know, what your equity would be worth at various valuations. So, you know, you own 0.05, multiply that by 100 million, you know, your equity would be worth $500,000, which is great. That's a lot of money. You know, if it turns out to be a $500 million company, it's $2.5 million. You know, at $1 billion, $5 million, $5 billion, $25 million, $10 billion, $50 million, right? These are obviously the best case scenarios, right? You're talking about huge sums of money. And, you know, this is in some sense why people get into this, because you have the possibility where your equity is worth incredibly more than your base salary. It all becomes a rounding error at that point. So, you know, the question is, where do you think your company ends up and kind of the distribution of outcomes and what the likelihood at different points are? Now, you know, people talk about things like golden handcuffs. And I think it's important to remember how vesting works. So, like, even in the best case scenario, right, let's say this is it goes from $20 million company to a $10 billion company in 2 years, right? This is awesome. You've basically, you know, you've got $50 million worth of equity in this company. The problem is, and it's a high-class problem to have, is that you've only vested half of it. So if you were to leave the company now, you would be leaving $25 million behind. And that's a pretty expensive thing to do, right? I think a lot of people would be loath to turn down $25 million if they just stayed at the company for another 2 years. And so when people talk about this, they talk about golden handcuffs, because the equity is incredibly valuable, but it's a huge, huge incentive to stay at the company for the period of time that you're vesting in something that's so valuable. And it becomes very hard, you know, if you're at a smaller company, try to recruit folks out of a very successful company, because no one's leaving, right? No one's ever going to leave if they're vesting $25 million over the next 2 years, right? It's hard to find a job that'll pay you $12.5 million a year. So that's what people mean when they talk about golden handcuffs. And it matters a lot what stage the company is at when you join them, because there's a very common risk-reward trade-off. The earlier you are, the more equity you're going to get, which means if things work out, you'll get rewarded for that. So if you're an employee 10 at a company versus employee 500, you're likely to make, quite frankly, orders of magnitude more than someone who joined much later. The benefit to joining late, of course, is that you know the company has some level of history, they've got a track record, you can see how things are performing, and so you're taking less risk because the company is likely to be worth something, but you're getting a lot smaller percentage of the company, so ultimately you'll make less off the equity. And there are a lot of trade-offs in life. It's mostly just about trying to figure out what's the right kind of company for you, what stage of the company, and what, you know, where you can be successful, but there's always a trade-off between these things. I think the one thing also that people tend to forget is even once they've vested their equity, they don't necessarily, you know, the question is what happens when you leave the company? And the easiest situation is when you have restricted stock units. So restricted stock units, you're basically just waiting, right? Until there's some liquidity event, IPO, something like that, you don't have to do anything. You're just waiting for the company to convert your RSU into a share, and then you can get, you know, you can turn that into cash. Options are a little bit different, right? You remember that options have some strike price. You have to pay the company for them. And it's very, very common that when you leave a company, you have a fixed period of time to exercise or your options expire. So, you know, you could imagine if you had something like $50 million worth of stock, you would clearly not want your options to expire. That would be, well, kind of crazy. But nonetheless, you still have to pay for it. So in this example where you had 150,000 options, you have to reach into your pocket and come up with 30 grand. You know, 30 grand is real money. But if you had $50 million worth of stock, that's a small price to pay for your equity. The thing that most people don't realize is that when you exercise an option, you have to pay taxes. And that tends to be where people get caught. So, you know, let's, you know, think about a good situation where, you know, your strike price is at 20 cents, but the stock is worth $10. Obviously, you want to exercise, but when you do that, not only do you have to pay the 30 grand, but you're probably going to have several hundred thousand dollars in taxes that are due. And an even better case, right, where the stock is worth $100, you know, you're going to owe millions of dollars in taxes. So these are good problems to have, but it's part of what's driving a lot of the activity on the secondary markets. People have options, they're leaving a company, those things are very valuable, they need a way to pay their taxes, and those dollar amounts can be quite large, and people are looking for ways to get cash, many times for no other reason than just to fund their tax bills. So I think that's part of the driving force behind why there's been so much activity on the secondary market for companies like Facebook and Zynga and a bunch of folks that have either gone public or kind of on that path. Now, there's one thing that you can do with options to make them more portable, right? People talk about early exercising, 83B. They tend to use those two terms synonymously, though they're slightly different. And what you can do with options is when you show up on day one, as opposed to just waiting to exercise until you know that the stock's going to be valuable, you could exercise it up front. Which means, you know, the good and the bad of that is you have to come up with 30 grand up front, and that's, you know, that could be a risk that you're not necessarily willing to take. But if you invest that money now, when you've converted your options into stock, and when you leave, it's your stock, right? There's nothing else you have to do. And because you exercised it up front when it was the cost of exercising was equal to the fair market value of that stock, there's no tax implication, right? So the whole issue about taxes goes away, and the question just becomes, are you willing to put up the 30 grand? And so when people talk about 83B, this is really a reference to a section of the tax code, and it basically just means that as opposed to paying taxes over time when you vest, you pay the taxes up front. And so if you do this in conjunction with early exercising, you don't pay any taxes, because when you early exercise, the stock's worth as much as you're paying for it. So this is, you know, things that people tend to use the terms synonymously, they usually go together. So let's just do a quick comparison between the various kinds of equity that you're likely to encounter as an, you know, on an offer letter. You've got ISOs, you've got NSOs, you've got RSUs. And so you can kind of look at these things based on, do you have to exercise, how tax efficient are they, and how portable are they? And ISOs are pretty good, right? You have to exercise them, but they're very tax efficient, and they're not necessarily portable, but if you choose to early exercise them, that can be, you know, that can be pretty valuable. Non-qualified stock options, you know, are just fundamentally worse, right? At the end of the day, you have to pay to exercise them. They're not that tax efficient, and they're not that portable. They have the same problems that ISOs have, but they're slightly worse. And then you've got restricted stock units. They're actually the simplest situation, right? You don't have to exercise them. You don't have to pay anything for them. They're not very tax efficient, but they are very portable. And so it just becomes a very, very simple way of, you know, having your equity in these companies. So, you know, fundamentally, the only way to get what you want is to ask for it. And so, you know, with that, kind of wanted to open up for questions. If you guys just try to keep the questions as generic as possible so they can be relevant to as many other people, that would be great. And there's a mic in the middle, which I think is where people have to ask questions. Can we do mic stuff so people can hear? I don't know if there's an easy way of...
Can you talk about SARs?
SARs? I mean, is this sort of like phantom stock?
Yeah.
Oh. Basically, what you're referring to is, it's basically a profit sharing when you really kind of get down to it. Companies, as opposed to issuing people stock, are, they're sort of paying cash as the value of the company goes up over time, and you can redeem it. I mean, it's basically like a bonus system. It solves certain things around employee ownership, so you don't have to worry about like the 500 shareholder account rules that have been a big issue, part of the reasons why, you know, Facebook's going public was the filing requirements, things like that. You know, you're getting comped as if it was compensation, so it's not as tax efficient as it would be if you own shares. It just depends. I mean, most tech companies don't go that route, but that's more of a convention more than any great reason to do one versus the other.
Can you explain a little bit how dilution works?
Sure. So, I mean, basically the way dilution works is that your ownership of the company is going to change over time. And the way to think about this, the way this tends to matter is when the company raises more money. So, you know, let's say you started out with, you know, in the examples that I did, you start out with half a point of the company. You know, if the company then decided that it was going to sell 50% of itself to an investor because they needed to raise $100 million or something like that, you would actually have a smaller percentage of the company. So as opposed to having 0.5 0.5%, you now have 0.25% because they sold 50% to an investor. You know what that means is that over time you have a smaller percentage of the company. You can think about your ownership as either on a percentage basis or on kind of what the share value is. So as the share value goes up, the total value of the company goes up, and you can calculate what it's worth to you in both situations. But the gist of it is, you know, over time you own a smaller and smaller fraction of the company. Does that make sense?
So he asked my question, but can you talk about drag-along, tag-along?
Kind of investor right sort of things?
Yeah.
Those things tend not to matter that much to employees. They tend to matter a lot to founders, partially because there are a lot more restrictions on the stock that they own. So, you know, you might have things like a co-sell right or whatever as a founder where if you try to sell stock, the investors can also sell stock along with you. You know, the benefit... It makes it much harder for founders to sell, right? It ties them up in ways that are potentially annoying and also reduces the value of their stock.
And which one makes it
harder
or not harder?
I mean, a co-sell right would probably make it harder. You know, like certain things like drag-along rights would allow investors to force other investors to vote on or like vote along with them. There can be voting agreements that would say, you know, you have to appoint someone to be on the board of a directors, so while you may technically get to vote, you don't actually get to vote. There are all sorts of various things that you can do from a corporate governance perspective that affect how much control someone who has ownership in the company truly has.
Hi, my company does services for startups.
And services for startups?
We do services for startups. We do a lot of cash and equity deals. Mm-hmm. So we do a bunch of development and take a piece of equity and some cash. And we are always struggling on how to structure the deal, which is a nightmare. And we deal with a lot of early stage companies. Some of them have no money. Yep. Most of them are LLCs. Sometimes it's just one guy. Sometimes they've got $100,000 or $200,000. Mm-hmm. Usually we wind up with some kind of a stock option deal, but my attorney's recommending we look at warrants. And I'm wondering what your reaction to that is.
So warrants and options are really the same thing. They're different words, and they tend to track who owns them, but the structure of them is the same, right? A warrant is... It's just an option, right? There's some strike price associated with it, and if you pay that strike price, the company will give you a share. It's just that you're a third party, and so if you're a company that owns them, they tend to get referred to as warrants.
The trouble on getting options from companies that are barely formed is they don't have an option plan. They can't give you an option, so you're getting them a promise. Warrant?
In that situation, I'd really just say they should give you stock, because the stock doesn't have any value associated with it yet, so there's no tax implication of you getting the stock. They have shares. They can just issue more.
But if they haven't issued shares, then they have to give you a warrant, right?
I mean, at some point in time, they have to do something. You know, if they haven't issued shares, they probably haven't really formed the company yet. Because when you form the company, you have to issue something.
Hence the dilemma.
The easiest answer is they either just give you shares if it's a really early company, like you're talking at, they have one person sort of thing. And if it's, you know, a slightly later stage company, the easiest thing is to get warrants, like I guess your lawyer suggested. But that would be a very reasonable way of going about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. Just on the founder side, I have a startup, very, very early stage.
Mm-hmm.
We're two, so it's pretty simple, 50-50 so far, okay?
Two founders, so 50-50?
Yeah, easy. Yeah. But employee number three coming on board, four, you know, very early employees. Sure. Usually how much, you know, fraction do you give them as a stock option? What's the standards, do you know?
For you know, I think you'll get very different answers depending upon who you ask this question to. I generally think that, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know if you've raised money. I think that tends to be kind of the dividing line between founders and employees, because if you're working at a company and you're not getting paid anything and you've done that for a while, you know, that's a lot of risk. And I think at that point in time, you should be getting sizable amounts of equity. It's hard to, you know, I can't tell you how you should give equity to people, but, at the end of the day, I think those sorts of people are taking a lot of risk. And, you know, once you've raised money and you're starting to pay people something, you know, similar to a market rate, you know, the amount of equity they should get should be substantially less because you've de-risked the company by quite a lot. You know, for really early employees before you've raised money, I mean, honestly, the answers range anywhere from like 1% to 20%. I mean, it's a really big range. So there's not a right answer on these sorts of things. It's a matter of what you're comfortable with and what that person's going to be happy with, because if you're bringing them in that early, you want them to be very excited about the company. And I don't think it's really worth, I mean, right now, owning 10% of nothing doesn't matter, right? You know, owning, so you got to make the pie bigger before it really matters what percentage of the pie you own.
Thank you.
Hi, can you discuss the difference between like the common stock and the preferred stock and, you know, and the series A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and all that sort of stuff, and how that would relate to the dilution and how somebody might protect themselves about those various things? And to piggyback on his question about, like, say, you're a founder of the company, it's like, you know, how do you try to hang on to some of it when you're going to go get those investors, you know, and how much was a reasonable amount for you to hang on, 50%, 10%? I mean, I'm completely new to this, so the whole ballpark idea would be helpful.
Sure. I mean, I think in some sense there aren't necessarily right answers, because some companies are very capital intensive and require a lot more money, and so therefore you're just going to end up owning less. If the company is very capital efficient, then you don't have to sell that much, right? So, you know, there are just certain things that happen to be true for one company that are not true for another. You know, in terms of the difference between preferred stock and common stock, the difference between preferred stock and common stock primarily is that there's certain rights associated with preferred stock, like perhaps a board seat, right? If you're an investor and you invest in preferred, that preferred stock will give you the right to be on the board. Usually you also have some kind of liquidation preference. So if I invest $1 million in your company and the company only is worth $1 million, I get my $1 million back, right? So you don't get anything in that context. That's really the most basic form of preferred. It should probably be what, you know, certainly in this environment people are raising. So, you know, over time, the way that you maintain your ownership is you create an auction for your stock at the end of the day, right? You're looking for investors. If three or four investors want to get in, you'll get a good price, right? And you'll get a market price. If there's only one guy who wants to invest, at the end of the day, you know, if you want the money, there's going to be some price associated with it. That's not to say that they should, you know, screw you over, but it's just to say that you have less leverage on, you know, what the outcome is. So the best way to maintain ownership in the company is to do as well as possible and get as many people to want to invest as possible.
All right, so let me couch this by saying I totally respect what you are talking about when you say owning 10% of nothing is nothing. But I think in a lot of startup situations, you have a group of people that have a varying set of skills, and they get together to start a company. And you may have some level of money coming in, you might not. Do you have any strategies for deciding or helping facilitate that conversation of, hey, who owns what? You know, saying you have, like, I'm sure a lot of us are in a situation where it's like you have someone that has an idea, maybe plus business. There's some developers, maybe there's some designers, you know, and everyone kind of joins up together. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone feels like their contribution is the one that matters in a friendly way. But how do you decide that?
I've gone through that process personally. I think you just need to have honest conversations with people, because if they're unhappy after going through that process, you run the risk that the team's going to break up and everyone, you know, may not contribute equally in value, but they all are perhaps important. And if they're not that important, perhaps they shouldn't be part of the team. So, you know, it's really about, I think, having a direct conversation with people and talking about what they're bringing to the table and what other people are bringing to the table, and making sure that, you know, in some sense, everybody thinks they're worth like 20% more than they actually are, and so there's not 120% to go around. So you've got to get, you know, everyone's going to have to give a little bit for the sake of building a team that they think is going to be successful. You know, the answers are, I mean, you can look at some of the big, like, consulting firms and stuff, like, they'll put together employee comp surveys and things like that. I mean, it sounds like you're having that conversation at the very early stages where that's less relevant. You know, as you're bringing, you know, as you start hiring lots of people, you can kind of go with industry standards. But, you know, when it's really just a small number of people, you gotta get into a room and everyone sort of has to be okay with the answers. The other way to solve this just by default is vesting, because people get their equity over time. And if it turns out that the assumptions that you made when you started are not true, people haven't just gotten all their equity up front, and then they can leave. It's really one of the hardest things to fix once people own their stock. It's very hard to go back and fix things. And so, you know, having everyone sign up to a vesting schedule over a reasonable period of time gives you some flexibility.
So understanding the nuts and bolts and vocabulary around equity comp is super useful, so thank you for that to start with. But here's a scenario for you. You start salary and equity negotiations with a new startup, and they refuse to disclose to you the number of shares they've released or the existing valuation of the company. How does a new prospective employee negotiate in that situation?
I mean, I think it's a hard situation. I think that if people aren't willing to give you some basic level of information, there's a real question of whether or not you actually want to work at that company. But, you know, at the end of the day, part of why you're going there is that they're trying to sell you on why this company is valuable and why things are going to be successful. And so it seems reasonable that they should be able to walk you through a process explaining why the equity that they gave you is valuable. And so even if they don't want to share perhaps the number of shares that they have at the company, they could walk you perhaps through the math of, well, if this company ended up being worth $100 million, what would that be worth to me? And you can back into these numbers, right? If they tell you what your equity is worth at various valuations, you therefore can figure out how many shares there are, right? So there may be different ways to get to the same information, but if they're not willing to walk you through and say, hey, if this is a $1 billion company, this is what your equity is worth, I don't understand how they could ask you to value that equity that they're giving you, and therefore, how could you make a decision and why would you want to be there if you can't?
Hi, my name is Greg. I'm a co-founder of Inkdit, and the last time that I had stock options myself was in January 2000.
Not a good year.
And I found it, by the time they vested, it was totally demotivating. So I'm just now kind of getting over that and considering offering this for my employees. It's been a while. I was like, it was terrible. So I've shied away from offering to employees just for that because of my own experience. And so I don't know, what are the thoughts around whether or not, you know, stock options are actually motivating and the quality of work associated with options? So, like, is there, we're working on an assumption, I think, in this room that options will, you know, have better output at the end of the day.
I mean, I think it's a very reasonable question. I mean, part of, it very much depends on kind of where, what stage of the company it is, right? Like, once the company gets public and people start tracking what their net worth is on a day-to-day basis because they can look at, you know, the NASDAQ and they're like, oh, well, we're up 10% today. Wow, I made a lot of money. Like, I think that can be very, very distracting, right? When you're in an early stage company, you know, people want to feel a sense of ownership. And that's certainly true within the tech community because I think there's a cultural bias for that. If you look anywhere else in the world, there is no employee ownership. Like, go look at any other country. Look at other parts of the U.S., right? Outside this industry, there's very little employee ownership. And so...
I'm Canadian, so... Yeah. I'm Canadian, so... Yeah.
Well, but you're within tech. Tech is slightly different. But, I mean, I think that's really the point, is that, you know, when within tech, people want to feel ownership over the outcome. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's really no other great way. I mean, you can call equity lots of different things, but without giving them a sense of that, I think that's how you can get the best talent, right? That's what the best talent's looking for. And so, you know, you want to be able to explain to them why the equity is valuable. And that's, I think, part of the process that's not happening right now. People give offers to someone, and they'll just have numbers on it with no context and no explanation. And I don't, you know, I think it's just very difficult in that situation to value the equity because you don't know what it's worth.
I'm wondering about a state like Texas. It's an employment at will state where an employee can be let loose for any reason or no reason. In that situation, could you compare ISOs and NSOs with respect to whether a person who's made an early exercise, for example, whether there's some difficulty in releasing that person if they're not working out? I think you said that NSOs are not subject to early exercise. Is that right?
No, you can. So early exercise is something the company has to allow you to do, but if they allow you to do it, there's no difference whether or not it's ISOs or NSOs. The point you bring up is actually an important one because I think people in general don't really ever consider the issue of getting fired. And in companies that are growing really rapidly, skill set, like the requirements of the job change, and sometimes, you know, people get let go for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with them. And you don't necessarily want to be stuck in a bad situation. So one of the issues that happens is like someone gets let go, and they have 90 days to exercise, right? Maybe they can come up with, you know, the amount to exercise, but they have no way of coming up with the taxes. And that becomes a really bad situation. I mean, I saw this with a bunch of folks, you know, at a variety of companies not that long ago in the Valley. And so, you know, it can put people in a really awkward situation. If you early exercise, the main reason why companies don't always allow early exercise is it creates an administrative burden. Because what happens is, normally when you vest, you vest options, and so the company doesn't have to do anything. You have to take an action, i.e. pay them, in order to get the share. If you early exercise, what happens is you own all the stock up front, but the company has the right to buy back some of it from you. And they can buy back less and less over time, right? So if you think about it, it's kind of like reverse vesting. So there's no problem with letting someone go, but the thing you have to remember as the company is you have to purchase that stock back from them, and you buy it back at the same price they bought it from you. So it's the same from the company's perspective, but they now have to take the action. And if you forget, it creates all sorts of problems, which a friend of mine recently discovered when he forgot to buy back someone's equity. So, you know, it's just a question of who kind of has to take the administrative burden there. But if you early exercise, you avoid all these problems with taxes and things like that.
But you do early exercise before it vests, right?
Yeah, you early exercise on day one, and then you own the shares, and the company has the right to buy them back from you at the same price you paid.
This may or may not be a technical question, but more an appeal to your collected wisdom. If you think of someone who's sort of already in a career, sort of, you know, has collecting a salary, has a certain path that they're on, but obviously is looking for opportunities and is considering taking on that level of risk that you talked about, how would you advise someone in those situations about assessing that risk, assessing the potential rewards versus sort of going down a more predictable path?
I mean, I think if you've decided that it's something that you want to do, then, you know, as long as your lifestyle supports it, you're willing to make whatever, you know, sacrifices that you might have to make, right? You could be making a lot more money today if you're willing to take a smaller salary, but you want to have an ownership in the company. I think that's a good, you know, that's a good place to be. You know, in terms of evaluating it, I think at a very basic level, right, if you're getting hired into a small company, you can talk to the people who are running the company, the people who started the company, and understand what their vision is and why they believe, you know, it's going to be something that's worth spending everyone's a lot of time on, right? You can talk to the investors of the company, right? You can, you know, you can talk to them and you can ask them why they invested, right? What are the sorts of returns that they're looking for? Because, you know, not every company will be successful, but at the very least, you understand that they think there's a possibility that it will be successful, and if it is successful, it'll look something like this. You know, you could talk to people who've joined other companies and kind of, you know, the process that they went through there. But I mean, really, if you talk to the founders or some of the executives and the investors, it's a really good place to start. And something that, if it's a very small company, should be, you know, that should be available to you. I mean, if you're joining a company that's 500 people, you know, that's a different thing. But, you know, 5, 6, 10, a dozen people, you should have access to that group of folks.
I didn't want to monopolize the mic, but I think I'm okay now. So I'm in process of a deal right now where essentially getting a certain number of shares, there's a current valuation and the like, but then also if there's a certain revenue hit for the company, not necessarily myself, there's additional shares. Mm-hmm. That said, there's a dilution implication there too. Can you address that a little bit?
So if a company goes from like 10 million in revenue to 20 million in revenue, you get issued more stock?
That's correct.
Okay. I mean, from a dilution perspective, that's good for you and quasi bad for everybody else, right?
Right.
I mean, you're getting issued more, which means your piece of the pie gets bigger, and that comes from everybody else because the pie always has to add up to 100. But, I mean, it's good for you, right? If you think that the revenue targets are possible, then it's a way for you to just be incentivized to help the company get to whatever the revenue target is.
Well, there's other people in that same situation too,
yeah,
potentially.
Yeah. Basically what they've just done is, most companies are cash poor, or they would rather spend their money on other things, and so they've just taken equity as another way to incentivize people to achieve a specific goal. And, you know, they could have done it, they could have given everyone a 25% bonus, whatever it was, right? This is just another way of doing that. And it's a totally reasonable thing.
Hey, thanks for your presentation. I was just wondering from an investor's perspective, when you look into the three different types you have, is there a preference from an investor's perspective which type you have chosen to structure your company share?
You mean in terms of ISOs, NSOs?
Exactly.
Yeah. The answer is yes. It mostly comes down to taxes. So, like, if you issue people non-qualified stock options, the company gets to take that as an expense, which is good for the company in terms of reducing their tax burden. You don't get that benefit with ISOs. I think as early stage companies, people don't really think about this stuff, and it tends not to matter that much. So, if you're an investor, I don't think anyone would say issue people one or the other. I think the overriding reason why people have created multiple different ways to give people equity is partially because the 500 shareholder count rules. It's partially because they're different you know, once the company gets to a certain size, the strike price becomes very high, and so it people don't feel as motivated, right? If they have a strike price of, you know, effectively like $1,000 or whatever, right? So, you know, RSUs work in that situation where you give people a fixed amount of equity that's worth something kind of no matter what. So it comes down to how do you incentivize people and how do you avoid certain regulatory issues. But from a how you know start a company, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Okay, thank you.
Hey. So from the employee's perspective, how can I tell whether the percentage I'm getting is fair?
So, I mean, fair is a difficult question always. I think that there's a bunch of industry information out there. If you go hunt around on the internet, you can find out, you know, what a director at a startup that's kind of X stage would get. It's a little hard to do comps across industries, but you can get some sense of it. It's always helpful if you have friends in the industry and you can kind of find out what people in similar situations are getting. I think the easiest way to do it is to look at what the equity is worth at various outcomes and decide whether or not you think that's fair, right? If you think, you know, if this company is $10 billion and I don't make $50 million, that's not fair, then, you know, that's not fair because you're kind of you're the final arbiter on what fair is, right? It has to be something that you're happy with. You know, and that's probably the easiest way to look at it, right, is what do you think is a likely outcome and do you make enough money at that outcome to be satisfied with the fact that you contributed to helping making that possible?
Okay, round two. So apologies if this is a very ignorant sounding question, but say that you have one of the first two types of stock and your company were to be acquired. How do you handle, I'm not in this situation, but I'm just theorizing. How would you handle paying those, or are the people that have that kind of stock just kind of SOL in some ways, if it's not RSU?
So, no, it's actually really simple, right? If you have an option to buy a share of whatever, of company A, and company B then acquires company A, you just now have an option to buy an equivalent number of shares of company B. So it sort of automatically works, right? This situation has happened many, many times, and the lawyers have figured out, you know, it's super standard, right? So you don't have to worry about, do I lose all my equity if there's some weird situation? You know, so people have certainly figured out weird situations to try to screw other people. So, you know, don't get me wrong, like, there are odd situations, but, you know, at the end of the day, like, if people are just trying to do normal things, it's not a problem at all.
So what is the tangible item that is transferred between the company and the employee? What do we need to create? Is it just written down in a document and say, hey, by the way, we changed the note. You got more this month?
So I think the funny thing is people don't always read all the documents they get. So when you join a company, there'll be a stock option agreement, and you'll get probably something like a 30-page document, which might be worth perusing. You don't really have any leverage to negotiate it because it'll probably be very standard. But you might want to look through what your rights are and how things work. So that's the tangible contract that you're signing with the company that gives you the right to buy a share if you pay X dollars, right? Once you buy the share, right, you exercise your option, the company will give you a stock certificate. It is a physical printed certificate that looks pretty. And, you know, if you physically hold it, right, it's yours. Some companies will keep their stock with their lawyers and it'll be escrowed there. But at the end of the day, right, the physical thing is the stock certificate or the contract. But there is a physical piece of paper.
And in follow-up to that, if I'm doing this for employees, where do we get these magical pretty papers?
Your lawyers.
Thank you.
Yep.
Always. I want to give some of my employees equity in my startup, a completely generic tech startup. And what unexpected or non-obvious advice would you have to give me? I know the obvious stuff already.
Non-obvious advice. I think people... don't trip your employees. I think in general, employees tend to get less of the pie than, you know, I think is on average reasonable. I think people are very... tend to be on average very cheap with equity, and I'm not sure why. So, you know, I would look at it as give people something that's going to make everybody, that everyone will be happy with at the end of the day, because actually one of my friends gave equity in his company to a lot of people that helped him out, just even not even that much at the very beginning, and it worked out incredibly well for all of them. And I just think life's more fun when all your friends are rich with you.